call the committee, the subcommittee on Metropolitan Council Accountability and Transparency together. Thank you for being here. We do have a set of minutes from the previous meeting, and have someone that would like to make that motion?
Motion to approve.
Okay, all in favor of approval, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, great. And just a couple of announcements. The Minority Leader Thiessen did appoint Representative Lane as the DFL lead on our committee, so thank you very much. And this next week's meeting, we will be moving till Wednesday because of some scheduling conflicts, so Wednesday in the government ops slot. So just so you know that, and we'll be talking about transit at that point. And today our meeting is about Thrive 2040. We want to sort of hear it from the beginning, and we're going to take about 40 minutes of testimony, or our presentation rather, and then we'd like to leave the remainder for questions, and we do have some testifiers as well. So Mr. Shetnan and Mr. Bourne, perhaps you want to come to the witness table. Mr. Bourne, Mr. Shetnan decided to stay back.
He's gonna see if I can do this. Big chance.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Bourne, just some things, sort of a bigger set of questions, perhaps. I mean, I think as we proceed through this, some questions come to mind, like, you know, what problems are we trying to solve in the Twin Cities metro region? You know, this is really central planning in the best and worst sense of the word, I suppose. But you know, why is this top-down central plan deemed to be superior to how we've been developing in the past? Because it seems to be quite a departure. And I look at the area as really a model metro area in terms of everything, jobs, housing, transportation. And so what are we trying to fix is really a big question for me. And have you contemplated any of the downsides? I mean, housing prices going up, congestion going up, some of those sorts of things. So if you might, you know, here and there, throw some of that in at us. So please proceed, Mr. Bourne.
Thank you. Good morning. Madam Chair, members. My name is Pat Bourne. I'm the Regional Administrator at the Metropolitan Council. As you know, we're a local unit of government, and if we were a city, I'd be the city manager or city administrator. I've got a few slides here to give you some overview about what our planning process is, how it's authorized, and how we've gone about it so far. And if you will, I'm sure if you have questions, stop me and ask questions. But I have some slides here that are going to be primarily of an overview nature. Many times we are asked, how are we authorized to do our planning work? So on the slide behind me is a direct language from Minnesota Statutes 473-145 that directly authorizes a comprehensive development guide for the metropolitan area. And in our terms, that's what Thrive is. Thrive is the name that this council has given to its development guide and its prior councils have named their development guides like we name children. And so that's why there is a name associated with this development guide. The Metropolitan Land Planning Act, adopted first back in 1974, anticipates a 10-year cycle of planning. It kicks off with the census, and in this case it kicked off with the 2010 census. The first step in this guide is the development guide named Thrive MSP 2040. The next thing that we're now engaged in, and by the way, we adopted that in May of last year, after considerable public engagement that I'll summarize in a few minutes. We're now into, as required by law, the systems and policy plans. We've adopted two of them so far. The other policy plans will be adopted pretty soon. That then is followed by system statements, and there are three of them. And then all of that work is then used to guide the update of local comprehensive plans done by cities and counties. And we have 180 municipalities in the seven-county region that are responsible for doing that, and we assist them in doing that. But all of those comp plans are then guided by the development guide, the policy plans, and the system statements, each of which are authorized by law. As we've named it, Thrive MSP 2040 is our long-range plan. It is aspirational in nature, among other things. The legislature created the council in 1967 to plan for the orderly growth of the seven-county metro area and coordinate the delivery of services that couldn't be provided efficiently by any one city or county, and there's a pretty specific list of the kinds of things that we do. Challenges and changes ahead. I think, Madam Chair, you've set the table well here. I'm going to talk a little bit more about population growth, but we expect the metro area to continue to be a thriving, exciting place to live, and a place where people move from other places to move here to take jobs and to enjoy the quality of life that we all enjoy here. We also know that there are constrained fiscal resources. New demands that we expect will come from a changing demographic pattern, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. We're also hearing about environmental challenges that cities are facing in managing and dealing with the infrastructure that they own and that we own together with them, and the necessity of regional cooperation for economic development. Might add that the name we chose for the development guide, Thrive MSP 2040, each of the parts of that name have important meanings to the region. Thrive for the expectation that we have that this region will continue to be a thriving, economically vibrant region, one of the most vibrant in the United States, competing with other regions all over the world, really. MSP, we've plagiarized a little bit from our friends at Greater MSP, the Economic Development Authority that was primarily privately financed and privately funded, but we find ourselves increasingly in a cooperative set of work and supportive work with them. And 2040, because our plan is a 30-year outlook for the region. So the Twin Cities are growing. That's not new. That's been going on for quite some time, and we have a few slides to demonstrate that. I'm going to talk a little bit about our forecast of population and employment and households. Those are really the fundamental bases for our planning work that's ahead. The forecast work we do are market-driven, and for the first time, much more economically sensitive. I would hesitate here at this point to underline the fact that our forecasts are what we think is going to happen, not necessarily what we want to have happen. Frequently, because we're the deliverer of that forecast, folks sometimes think, oh, gee, that's just what they want to have happen. No, these are forecasts based on current economic conditions, current demographic patterns, and frankly, patterns that we're seeing throughout the U.S.
Mr. Bourne, if I could, though, insert, I realize it was 40 years ago, but at that time the estimate was we'd be a 4 million population by 1990, was it?
Madam Chair, I've only been in this job 4 years, and I've paid very close attention to the work that we're doing today. I can't confirm or deny. You may be absolutely right.
All right. Thanks.
So, here's what we think about the next 30 years. Growth is going to happen. Job growth is certainly going to happen. After a pretty dismal last 10 years of two recessions between 2001 and 2010, when actually employment fell in the region, we expect that employment to rebound well in the next decade and the decades, the two decades that follow. This 36% job growth over the next 30 years will mean more than 500,000 more people will be employed that are employed today. And that job growth attracts people to this region, sometimes slowly, but it attracts people to this region. And that's true of every region in the United States. People go to where the jobs are. We think employment is going to grow pretty rapidly in the next 10 years and a little bit slower in the next 20 years. This growth compares to a net employment loss, as I mentioned, during the 2000s and the previous gains of 34% in the 70s, 22% in the 80s, and 26% in the 90s. We also think there are going to be more people who live here, 29% population growth over the next three decades, roughly a percent per year. And as you can see from the history here, that growth pattern is, we expect to continue that growth pattern that we've seen over the last 40 years. So we're now predicting 3.6 million people to live in the seven-county region by 2040. Interestingly enough, the gain of employment, or the gain of population, will include, we think, 350,000 of new residents through international migration, but losing about 125,000 people to domestic out-migration. These are not new patterns. These patterns have existed here for quite some time. That means that we expect a new net in-migration into the region of 225,000 people over the next 30 years. Let's talk about households. We think we're going to see a growth of about 35% of new households in the next three decades, topping out just a little over 1.5 million by 2040. That household growth, we think, is going to occur every place, in virtually every part of the region that we categorize. These categories that are on the chart behind me are categories that our planners use, that city planners use across the region. But you can see that in varying degrees and varying speeds, we expect and are forecasting growth of households to be across both urban, suburban, rural, and what we call suburban edge communities. Again, some faster than others, but we expect that growth to be pretty robust. Underlying these demographic forecasts are some changes that we think are important that should be considered in all of our planning work and in the planning work that cities and counties are doing as well. First is that we're going to see a continued growing diversity on racial and ethnic terms. Population is aging pretty rapidly, and a changing mix of household sizes. While these are regional trends that we're forecasting, they are also national trends that are being seen elsewhere. We have our own story to tell here, and this is our story, but these trends that we're seeing are not remarkable at all nationally. Let's talk about race. We think that over the let's just look at the last 20 years, 25 years almost, by example. In 1990, 99% of people who lived in the region were people of color. In 2010, that number had jumped to 24%. by the census. And in 2040, that trend will continue to be about 40% of people of color. These are changes that are significant to our population. So why is this occurring? A couple of reasons, I think. Birth rates are higher for families of color than for white families, contributing to the steady and gradual increase of racial diversity in the region. We will also continue to be a migration and immigration gateway throughout the 30-year period. Again, a continuation of trends that have been with us for quite some time. But immigration is going to substantially accelerate the region's diversity trend. Of all the expected international immigrants, 85% of people will be of color from all continents. Unlike my ancestors who came from northern climates in Europe 160 years ago, these folks are coming from warmer places. And they come with the same stories that that my ancestors and probably your ancestors came with as well. The number of white residents aged 25 to 64, the population that we normally think of as the most employable period, is going to, we think, shrink by 19%. Concurrently, the working age population of people of color will more than double from about 300,000 to about 700,000 by 2040. Within that workforce, diversity will grow. By 2040, people of color will comprise 42% of working age residents. We're going to have more seniors. No big surprise. 1 in 10 in 1990 were seniors. 1 in 9 in 2010. Slight increase. But by 2040, 1 in 5 people are going to be over 65. And that has some pretty important implications for where people choose to live, how they choose to live, and the nature of people who live here. Let me just make one more note, because I think it's an important and interesting by 2040, we're going to have more seniors than children under 14 of age, which is a pretty interesting development for us. Again, these are not remarkable when you compare our region to other urbanized regions in the United States. But it's our story. Senior growth is going to drive how households look. And households are important. The size of households are important to choices that people make about where they live and how they live. We are forecasting a significant growth in senior households with seniors. 1 in 6 in 2010, 1 in 3 in 2040. That's a significant increase. The net additional housing implied are in line with historical trends, but the balance of market demand is, we think, going to be different in the next 30 years. The number of senior-headed households will grow by 200,000, driven upward by aging and longevity of baby boomers. We're living longer, and there are a lot of us baby boomers. But as we leave the ranks of family age or working age households, those market segments are going to grow at much reduced rates. The number of family age or working age households with two or more people will grow only by about 67,000 over that 30-year period, just 17% of expected household growth. With seniors making decisions for about 32% of the region's households in 2040, their needs and preferences will become a predominant driver of housing for housing. These are very important trends for cities and all of us to be aware of. In other words, we see very little growth among households likely to buy 4-bedroom, 3-car garage suburban homes that were so important to the growth of this region in the last 20 years. Instead, we think most of the household growth is occurring among seniors and likely smaller households. So, with this growing and changing population, there are several challenges that we think are facing us. Taken together, the forecasted changes make one thing clear. The future is not likely to be our past. And because it's not, the Council developed this plan differently than past plans. In order to develop Thrive, the Council conducted an unprecedented amount of public engagement and used new approaches to connect with residents throughout the region. This is some work that we are very proud to have done, and it's paid off. We held more than 100 meetings, and the dots on the chart here simply represent where those meetings were held. The one in Stillwater, we actually had several meetings in that same location.
And Mr. Bourne, I brought along some comments. This is someone gathered these from your offices, so lots of comments. But
absolutely.
Just my experience, were people allowed to speak, or were they simply directed to make written comments? Was there interaction, I guess, in these meetings?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we got all kinds of comments in all kinds of ways. We started with a listening tour, I'll call it, of the region, in which we simply said, we're getting started with this work and we want to hear from you. And we simply listened. We took testimony. We heard people in various kinds of ways. We then took that work back, did some work, and we went back out and said, okay, we heard you. How about this? So these 2,000 people that went to these 100 meetings really were the other fundamental piece of information that we had in addition to these demographic forecasts. And we showed people the forecasts, and we asked them to respond to them and react to them and say, what does this tell you? What do you think this means? We try to do things that governments don't do in these public meetings, where we say, how about this? We didn't do that at first. We said, we're getting started with this. We want to know what you think. Tell us where you want the region to go, and we listened to them.
Mr. Bourne, if you could just give us a timeline, over what period was the plan, you know, discussed in your offices and then opened up to comment to input, I guess, from the citizens to finalization? What was that timeline?
It took about 2 years, about 2.5 years. We began holding these public meetings either late in 2011, early 2012, and then in May of 2014, Thrive was ultimately adopted. And we took testimony and heard from people in various ways during that entire period. And I'm sure that what you have in front of you is but a portion of the comments that we got. And they're available in various ways if anyone would like to take a closer look at them. So here's a meeting we had in Jordan. We asked this question about what does our region need to thrive? What kind of region do we want for our kids and for our children's children? What decisions can we make today that will set us on a good path? And we got plenty of comments, as the chair has in front of her. We also used the internet. Gee, we didn't do that 10 years ago when this work was done 10 years ago. And there are some people who prefer not coming to public meetings. How about that? They would rather tell us what they think online. And we got 500 users during the idea gathering and discussion site that we created for this. We got 508 comments, and we asked people to vote on things, and they voted more than 2,000 times.
Mr. Bourne, I'm going to pause you a minute. I think
Sure.
We have a question. Representative Bash?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Bourne, question for you. As someone who attended some of the meetings in a municipal capacity as my former role as mayor, I don't remember hearing about the municipal comment in your presentation here, because my question is this. There was a fair amount of disparity from what I saw in cities in my own region in Carver County with what we saw actually happening on the ground and what your plan was projecting. And the back and forth between the municipalities and the council resulted in some fairly dramatic changes, and I was hoping you might be able to address that for us, because some cities were shown as shrinking, some were seen as not growing enough, and I was hoping you could comment on that.
Oh, well, if you're talking about our demographic projections, we do these projections, and we do them first at the regional level, and then later we break them down into actually quite small geographic areas, but they include cities and counties as well. We show them to all those cities. We ask for their comments. Sometimes we make forecasts of growth that cities don't think that they're going to experience, and sometimes we are forecasting growth that is, we don't always agree on the expectations that those cities have. And so, and maybe the cities in the part of the region that you represent, I wouldn't be surprised if they are on both sides of the forecasting divide that we find ourselves in sometimes. But the forecast at the city level also considers how much land is available for development, what cities' existing comp plans provide for development. But it's not uncommon for us to have differences of either opinion or facts about what that might be. Where the facts are different, where we might not have the right information about what land use is being guided for development in a city, that's very important for us to know. Or if the starting point for our forecast was simply wrong, we have corrected the forecasts for those reasons. But we do take these region-wide forecasts of population and where people are going to live, and then we allocate those among cities. And in some cases there are disagreements, and in some cases there aren't big disagreements. But ultimately, we've got to make this forecast, and we come down on, ultimately have to do that forecast, and we then update those. We will be updating our forecasts as well, and we hear from cities all the way along on that score. I can't specifically answer the individual city situations in your cases, but it's not uncommon.
Please proceed, Mr. Bourne.
From this outreach work that we did, and this is one that I think occurred in St. Paul, themes emerged in the responses we got from the public. We asked members of the community, along with community and business leaders, to provide their ideas and vision for the region. Their input shaped Thrive's outcomes of stewardship, prosperity, equity, livability, and sustainability. And I'll say a little bit about each one of those, as well as the principles that we developed for integration, collaboration, and accountability. So, outcomes. This is a new development from past development guides, and it arises out of this incredible community engagement that we heard. Residents said to us that they want us to think about five things as we are doing our work, and our work represents both the guidance of land use and the making of infrastructure investments. Those are our two primary and policies relating to both of those. What they told us, boiled down, were, we want you to try to achieve these five outcomes and think about these five outcomes as you are doing your work over the next 30 years. And I'll have a little bit more to say about all of them. Now, we had to make judgments about what we were hearing because we heard a lot of things. But we thought it boiled down to these five outcomes. And so we want to hold ourselves accountable to these as we are doing our work. Let me talk about stewardship just for a second. Stewardship advances.
Mr. Bourne, we've got a couple questions.
Sure.
So I think Representative Albright?
I think, Madam Chair, I'm going to wait until Mr. Bourne completes his, and then I have some overarching questions, mm-hmm. and I think it's more pertinent after he completes them.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question as you did all the public engagement. What was the proportion, you might say, between elected officials, public city officials, and the regular public.
Mr. Bourne.
Boy.
Mr. Bourne, please go through the chair.
Certainly. Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have a handy guess. I'm guessing that of 2,000 people that we heard from, I would expect we heard from several hundred local elected officials, many of whom came to our public meetings. Some we met with individually, county commissioners, city council members, mayors, legislators, I'm sure, and others. It was several hundred, I'm sure.
Representative Lane, a follow-up?
Okay.
Right. Mr. Bourne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This outcome, stewardship, calls on us to prioritize the protection of and minimize impacts to natural resources. It asks us to focus on maintaining existing infrastructure, wastewater, highways and bridges, rather than expanding to serve new areas. Strategically invest in new infrastructure capacity that supports the land use patterns that we need to have to grow. But also expanding the alignment of our wastewater transit and other infrastructures together with land use. I might add here that all of the work that we do is intended to efficiently use infrastructure systems, primarily transportation and wastewater. One of the reasons why the region enjoys some of the lowest subsidy rates for transit and some of the lowest costs for wastewater in the United States, we're in the top five on those categories, is because we've paid so close attention over a long period of time to spending on infrastructure for these two big systems, transportation and wastewater, connected so closely to development. We tend not to overbuild things. We tend to build as development occurs, and we tend to build tend to build these infrastructure systems along with development that occurs. And that makes for much more efficient use of those systems. I'd love to take credit for that myself, but I can't. We just have really great people doing this planning work and operating these two systems. Prosperity is the second outcome. Prosperity refers to creating a vibrant regional economy that provides opportunities for everybody. It results from investments, we think, in infrastructure, amenities, and qualities of life that create a regional economic competitiveness, attracting new businesses, making the ones here more successful, a talented workforce, and subsequently and consequently greater wealth for everybody. Regional balance is important to us, too, and when we use this term, it's referred to geographic balance of investments across the region, and that no part of the region, despite what any of them think from time to time, that we're favoring or ignoring anybody. To advance prosperity, the former outcome, the Council will intentionally consider regional balance, that is, balancing investments and activities across the region, both for planning and operations and investment decisions. Council's intent is that no part of the region is consistently favored or consistently ignored. Advancing regional balance is a consideration that helps all of the region receive investments that promote prosperity at their stage and level of development. Equity is next. Equity connects all residents to opportunity and creates viable options for people of all races, ethnicities, and incomes so that communities share the opportunities and challenges of growth and change. We live in a region that's very robust economically, and it's resilient. It performs well in comparison to other regions in the U.S. Of the nation's top most 25 most populous regions, We have the highest overall employment rate of any of them at 76%. We have the second highest rate of home ownership of 70%. This is 2012 information. And the second lowest level of poverty at 11%. Those are statistics that are the envy of other regions in the U.S. These comparisons, though, underscore the region's performance, but they conceal something. And I think for some of us, the embarrassing fact that we have the largest racial and economic and ethnic disparities in the country. Employment rates for people of color is only 65% compared with 79% for white folks, the largest disparity by race across any region in the U.S. 26% of residents of color are in poverty here, compared with only 6% for whites. Once more, the largest disparity. 37% of people of color own their homes, compared with 76% of whites. Again, the largest disparity. We think that information, together with our forecast of a doubling of the percentage of people of color in the region, is important for us economically to understand. Not only is it a matter of our own individual expectations of each other, but it's an economic necessity that we find ways and ask ourselves constantly about what is everybody's role to deal with this very important, pressing issue for the next 30 years. Our region will fail economically where it has prospered mightily if everybody doesn't prosper. Let's talk about livability. Livability focuses on the experience of people and how places and infrastructure create and enhance a high quality of life that makes this a great place to live. The council contributes to regional livability by providing transportation choices that reduce financial and time of transportation, preserving natural resources and support outdoor recreational opportunities through our regional park and trail system, and working to communicate the regional bicycle network to promote bicycling for transportation and recreation. Sustainability protects our region's vitality for generations to come by taking a long-term perspective to preserve our assets, resources, and strengths. The council will work to promote the wise use of water through expanding water conservation and reuse, increasing aquifer recharge, and rebalancing surface water and groundwater use. We will also continue our own sustainability practices in our wastewater and transit operations. To the extent we can, we're going to offer leadership, information, and technical assistance to local governments who are already engaged in this work. We heard from a very active group of 20, 25 cities that are already banding together on a variety of sustainability initiatives. We found ourselves a little behind them, frankly. Thrive also includes a number of features that I won't talk about. This is the size of the document that apply policies to specific places. This is about moving beyond one size fits all. In our region, communities are growing, developing, and redeveloping in much different ways as they respond to their own unique histories and their own local aspirations. And that should continue. This is a map loved by our planners, so bear with me and I won't dwell on this too much. But planners across the region, our own, of course, arrive at community designations. This is how land is used throughout the region in a variety of ways. I'm not going to, I'm uniquely disqualified to tell you about each of the ways that we do this, but we do make community designations after considerable consultation with cities. This is a map that that designates communities by usually land use, and we do this to create similar policies for similar places defined by these development patterns and opportunities that and challenges. These designations are used to plan and implement regional policies at the local level through city and county comprehensive plans. Different communities will have different paths to each of our Thrive outcomes. We agree that one size doesn't fit all, and we're having conversations with communities about what our outcomes may mean to them. Among these policies are density expectations for new development and redevelopment. Council developed these proposed density expectations by examining what's being built across the region. Certainly a hot button that you're hearing about. I'm almost at the end. Principles. We developed these three principles. This is kind of the how we're going to go about doing this work, not the end result. The outcomes are the intended end result. The principles are going to be the way that we want to go about doing this work. Integration, collaboration, and accountability. These identify our three core principles that will guide both our staff and our policymakers as they both make decisions and implement our policies. So, areas of emphasis. New challenges are facing the region. Outcomes we think are important to keep in mind as we do our work and as everybody else engages in this work also. But there are some new concepts here. Water supply and water sustainability, I think, is the coming issue for the region. Many of you probably are aware of that in your own communities. Economic competitiveness and continued prosperity of the region is, we think, important for everyone. As I mentioned earlier, equity in racially concentrated areas of poverty and being conscious about them is also important. And resilience to changes in our climate that we're experiencing, especially as it relates to the management and maintenance of our infrastructure systems. And I'm sure I'm done with my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to answer questions. More questions.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bourne. I'll just throw out a quick one. I mean, the five principles, or I'm sorry, the five outcomes, do you expect any further definition of those? Will those become at all quantifiable? Will those be set forth in any sort of measured way so that, I mean, right now it sounds like extremely subjective. And if you're a municipality and wanting to know what's the future going to be, mm-hmm. it seems like it's really going to be in your hands because, as I understand it, these things have the force of law. But maybe you can share how you see the interaction. But subjective outcomes, subjective goals that you control mean that it's up to you.
Madam Chair, let me try to answer that in a couple different ways. One is that Thrive does name these five outcomes, goals, if you will, for the region. We also have the policy plans and system statements and ultimately the comprehensive plans that cities and counties do. We will be looking for how those outcomes are expressed in each of those remaining policy plans, system statements, and then ultimately in the comp plans. And so there will be more expressions of those outcomes and how they might be expressed in each of those policy plans. We have also and are continuing to develop what we call measures of accountability. Those are things that I didn't prepare to talk to you about that today, but we can come back and certainly talk to you about those measures that we think are going to measure each of those outcomes. They're pretty at pretty high level. There are about 25 or 30 of them. We published them. We've asked for comments on them. We've gotten some comments on them. We're going to start publishing and watching those and ask everyone who we work with to deal with us on those. The tone of your question, though, Madam Chair, suggests more power, I think, with the Met Council than I think sometimes we think we have. We are suggested that we are we have some iron hand and fist that we are using. Council's history, and I don't expect this to be different now, is one of collaboration. One of our principles of behavior is collaboration. This council did that, I think, well in seeking advice and comment, and both from elected officials and from the public, in the work that we've done so far, and we'll continue to do that. While others may fear some control by us, and we do have a role to play as state law provides, the way we go about doing that is certainly not, we don't want to be judged as being harsh or controlling. This is a collaborative work that we're engaged in with cities and elected officials together, and the business community.
All righty, thank you. We do have two questions. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bourne, being kind of a student of history and understanding the genesis for the Met Council, I'm just wondering what, in your opinion, was enumerated in the original charter as responsibilities of the Met Council?
Mr. Bourne, or perhaps...
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, if you're a better student of history, and I'll bet you are, you may have a better answer to your question than I do. I think our interpretation of what our mission is I'd boil it down to three words. Efficient regional growth. And we do that through policymaking and investments in infrastructure that we have responsibility for. Efficient meaning efficient use of infrastructure. Regional meaning we take a big picture view of the region. And growth meaning we think we play some role and should play some role in advancing the economic growth and vitality of the region. So it seems to me the outcomes that we've enumerated are consistent with that, and the way that we'll go about doing this work in collaboration with others is the tone that we want to set, both for our staff and for our policymakers, and how we expect to be judged and seen by others.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bourne. Then to follow on to that question and more of in a philosophical tone, and goes to the mission statement that obviously you try to adhere to. Would you say that your mission is to accommodate growth in the region or to direct growth?
Mr. Bourne.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I would say that our ability to, even if we thought we could direct growth, I think our expectation that we could do that, even if we thought we should, is it would be misguided. I think we also know that making investments in both infrastructure and transportation do have growth pattern results. So we're both accommodating growth that we are forecasting. And we show that forecast by cities and where that land use is guided by cities to occur. We're anticipating growth. We're supporting growth where we think it will happen. But it's inevitable that in making some kinds of infrastructure decisions, growth we expect will occur as a result of those. Maybe not right away. Maybe not always. But we know that growth will occur as a result of those infrastructure decisions, but we want those infrastructure decisions to be made in collaboration with local governments and being informed by growth patterns that do occur.
Madam Chair, I just have a follow-up then to
Ms. Representative Albright, and we're going to get to our testifiers.
Thank you. You mentioned the word forecasts, and you also in your testimony said that forecasts are what we think will happen, not what we want to happen. And so are you suggesting that your planning contradicts or goes against the grain, if you will? And I specifically think about the development that occurs outside of the urban core. It would be my understanding, based upon a student of people, as they mature, want to have their part of the American dream, which probably suggests moving out to where they have a little more land or a little more space between they and their neighbors. But to your point about Thrive 2040, doesn't what you have in 2040 contradict the national trend lines of the transient nature of the population?
Mr. Bourne?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. No, actually, we think that the patterns of development that we're experiencing here in general are seen elsewhere. Not exactly. We have our own, as I said, our own stories and our own individual community expectations. Choice is important. People make choices about where they choose to live and where they choose to put their businesses. And it's important for planners, whether it's our planners or the planners in municipalities, to recognize that choices are being made by residents. To think otherwise is some level of importance that I think is misguided. We all need to be humble in doing that work. So I don't think that our forecasts or our plans are at all at odds. The forecast needs to inform our planning work and the planning work done by municipalities. Mm-hmm. And they're updated pretty regularly. This is a 10-year planning cycle at least. Some of our plans are updated more frequently. Our transportation plan every 4 years. We're now able to do an update to our demographic projections annually. I don't know that we will do it annually. You don't want to make sudden shifts that quickly. But we're now able to update those things so that we can take into account trends that are happening within those 10-year time frames.
Thank you, Mr. Bourne. I think we're going to move on to the next questioner, Representative Fenton, and then we'll get to our testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bourne. I'm just trying to understand, and you talked about collaboration, but one thing I have read through the 2040 plan, it's been a while, but can you clarify, does the overall plan include add on to the 7 metro county, like an additional 9 counties, 2 of which are in Wisconsin?
Mr. Bourne.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. We're thinking, with, I'll just say, one exception. Our work is 7 county oriented. We do have this friendly relationship with Greater MSP, the nonprofit that advances business development in a 16-county, maybe 19-county area. So we hang around with them sometimes, and they hang around with us sometimes. But our responsibility is a 7-county region. The only, and it's a pretty small exception to this, we and the Transportation Advisory Board allocate federal transportation funds in the region. So under federal law, based on census data and how those census tracks are defined by federal law, the last one did ask us that our Metropolitan Planning Organization work, which is a pretty specific term done for allocating federal transportation funds, did ask us to include a little bit into Wright County and a little bit into a couple of communities in Wisconsin. But that's just for MPO purposes and not for general Met Council purposes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Bourne and folks, we have several elected officials from various local governments, but first we'll hear from Catherine Kirsten, who has... your presentation is very top line, so I think maybe we'll try to understand more about what the impact is. And I believe Catherine Kirsten from the Center American Experiment will share with her ideas and her thoughts. Good morning. Please give us your name and introduce yourself.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Catherine Kirsten. I'm a senior fellow at Center of the American Experiment. I'm here today to talk about Thrive MSP 2040. As we all know, the Met Council was created in the mid-1960s with a limited, straightforward vision to accommodate growth through orderly, efficient planning of regional infrastructure. But the Council's credibility and accountability gaps, as Minnesota's legislative auditor has called it, has widened over the years, a result, I'm sad to say, of the legislature's piling on powers while failing to provide any meaningful oversight of the Met Council. Today, the citizens of the Twin City metro area are burdened by an unaccountable regional government that neuters the power of our local elected officials, dictating to and even overruling them. The Met Council's assault on local control has reached a watershed with approval of Thrive MSP 2040. With Thrive, the Council is using its dual role as planning czar and funding gatekeeper to pick winners and losers among our region's 186 municipalities and to impose its own sweeping priorities on local communities as a condition for their receipt of funds and planning approval. Local officials must cower and bow, unable to object on behalf of their constituents for fear of, yes, retaliation. The Thrive Plan is based on a fundamental assumption that central planning, as we heard, by unelected social planners, is the key to the Twin Cities region's continued prosperity and high quality of life in the years ahead. In fact, our region's remarkable success to date is due not to central planning by bureaucrats, but to the enterprise and the entrepreneurship and the hard work of its people. The Met Council's power grab in Thrive raises this vital question. Will the people of the Twin Cities region continue to govern their own communities through their elected representatives, as they have a right to do? Or will the Met Council increasingly usurp the authority to decide how we live and what the character of our communities is going to be? The Thrive Plan epitomizes what Forbes.com columnist Joel Kotkin has said about smart growth planners generally. And believe me, this is part of a national movement with a national philosophy. Kotkin said, "The people designing your city don't care what you want." Now, this plan has four fundamental objectives. First, to densify our region and impose transit-oriented development, which is designed, and this is a national trend, as I said, to remake our region around transit, nudge us into high-density stack-and-pack housing along fixed rail lines, deplete road funding and increase congestion, and push us out of our cars so that we walk, bike, or take public transit to work and leisure activities, even in Minnesota's harsh winters. Its second objective is to empower unelected bureaucrats to funnel jobs and economic growth into our region's favored urban center and areas a half mile from transit stations, thereby distorting market forces and sapping developments in the rest of the region. Its third objective, to remake our neighborhoods and municipalities to apportion people in a government-approved mix of race, ethnicity, and income, allocating poverty across the metro area and pressuring cities to pay for low-income housing. For the Met Council, the solution to poverty is dilution. Its fourth objective is to redistribute wealth from the suburbs to the urban core to pay for all of this. Under the Thrive Plan, suburban residents will pay more in taxes but get less in infrastructure and services. But this is just the beginning of the Met Council's ambitions. I urge you to read their 140-page housing policy plan to see. In Thrive, the unelected council maintains that its mission includes solving complex social problems like income inequality and the racial learning gap, as well as mitigating climate change. These are matters over which the legislature has given it no authority whatever. Housing, for example, is not a system over which the legislature has given the Met Council statutory authority. But the council has adopted an unprecedented 140-page housing policy plan, which is overflowing with top-down controls. This plan will unleash a crusade to remake our metro area in a denser, more compact form. I use the plan's own words. It mandates development patterns in both developed and developing communities that, quote, support high transit demand to, quote, improve residents' ability to live without a personal vehicle. In other words, it calls for herding the region's people into dense urban enclaves to build ridership for fixed rail transit and buses. As one critic has lamented, do we all have to live in a 1,500-foot condo above a coffee shop on a transit line? Under the plan, communities like St. Louis Park, Hopkins, West St. Paul, South St. Paul will have overall density expectations of 20 units per acre, just like Minneapolis and St. Paul, despite their suburban character. Some developed suburbs, like Minnetonka and Wayzata, must plan to increase density by about 30%. The plan threatens to push so much of our region's land into high-density zoning that it will create an artificial shortage of single-family zoned land, causing higher prices for all new homes in the region. But the Met Council, of course, can't really change people's housing preferences, whatever its illusions. If people can't get what they want here, they will leapfrog, as many have already done, outside the seven-county metro area to another, or to another part of the country that has the kind of housing they want and can afford. The Thrive Housing Plan also aims to achieve a government-approved apportionment of people on the basis of their skin color and income. In 2013, the council mapped every census tract in our seven-county area here by race, ethnicity, and income, dividing them into racially concentrated areas of poverty and high opportunity clusters. With its housing plan, it essentially seeks to overlay one on top of the other. But the plan pressures cities and their taxpayers to finance subsidized housing themselves, since federal funds for this purpose have largely dried up. Many cities simply cannot afford the tab. Under the law, the council has no authority to enforce its affordable housing directives. But in the Thrive Plan, the council attempts to strong-arm cities into complying with its directives by tying receipt of transportation funds it controls, funds intended to relieve highway congestion and improve highway safety, to how much a city's housing policies disperse regional poverty. Now, a top-quality road system is vital to the Twin Cities region's continued prosperity and quality of life. And here's why. A key to regional growth and prosperity is how many jobs people can access within a commute time of 30 minutes. In the Twin Cities region, only 11% of our jobs are located in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul. In our spread-out region, the average employee can reach only 7% of jobs by transit within 45 minutes. Under these circumstances, cars are and will remain the fastest and the most convenient way to get to the vast majority of jobs. The transportation plan's focus, however, is on transit-oriented development, which disfavors cars and favors rail transit, biking, and walking. Over time, this policy will seriously reduce opportunity in our region and sap prosperity. The Transportation Policy Plan declares that, quote, expanding our roadway system is not a sustainable way to address congestion, climate change, equity, and livability. It instructs cities to consider, quote, travel modes other than the car at all levels of development. It's really hard to exaggerate the anti-auto bias of the Transportation Policy Plan, which is crammed with fuzzy, ideologically freighted language like this. Under the plan, the freedom of mobility that we now enjoy with our individual automobiles will be increasingly curtailed. While the plan virtually ignores funding for road expansion, it lavishes funds on fixed rail, an inflexible 19th century technology. Though 99% of area trips use roads in some way today, while less than 1% used fixed rail. On September 29, 2014, the county commissioners from the five ring counties, Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Scott, and Washington, issued a unanimous statement declaring that Thrive's transportation plan, quote, represents a bleak future for the regional highway system in most counties. the plan will provoke a, quote, radical shift in how the transportation system is built and operated, causing, quote, severe congestion and safety issues, and, quote, impacting the suburban county's tax base and quality of life, reducing the economic vitality of the region and of greater Minnesota. Thrive's anti-suburb bias, which the commissioners deplored, is particularly indispensable when you realize that in the next 25 years, only 16% of the region's population growth will be in Minneapolis-St. Paul and 84% in the suburbs, according to the Met Council's own figures. In December 2014...
Ms. Kirsten, yes, if I could interrupt. So just a couple more minutes, if you can give
us
that.
Yes, I've got 30 seconds.
Okay.
In December 2014, the council tweaked the transportation plan, but commissioners dismissed the changes as largely window dressing. Thrive's intrusive top-down controls threaten to raise our cost of living, reduce disposable income, and increase poverty in our region. We can expect the Met Council's densification and transit-oriented development crusades to raise housing prices and the cost of driving and to make it far more difficult for people of all income levels to access the wide range of jobs as they search for employment that they both need and desire. Over time, people of all income levels are likely to flee to less regulated, more affordable parts of the country. Regional planning should facilitate citizens' choices about how and where they want to live and shouldn't impose the council's preferences and penalize people for their choices. Planning should not seek to transform the Twin Cities into a dense, compact region where driving is discouraged. It should aim at raising the standard of living and reducing poverty by keeping all housing affordable, improving mobility, and reducing counterproductive regulatory barriers to economic activity. If we want our region to thrive, the Thrive Plan is the last way to achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one question. Representative Lane.
Well, it's a comment. We transitioned between speakers here. I was called out for an appointment to Isaiah, which is a church-based group, and people who use transit. And a young man who actually lives, it turns out, he didn't realize it, he lives just a few blocks from me in Columbia Heights, and it takes him an hour and a half to get to work in St. Paul as he has to get to the bus, get to the transit, get across town. The light rail saved him 10 minutes, he said. And he lives in a home in the residential area that I live in. It isn't high density. I am four blocks from Minneapolis boundary, so I'm suburban. But this is a whole metropolitan area here, and transit is extremely important for people. We have been saying that millennials, that's the young people up to about 30, and the older folks as we age, that transit will become increasingly important for us, and the millennials are looking for jobs in which they can not have a car. I do remember one of my daughters who's older now, she's past millennial, she did study abroad in England at one point, and she came home and said, I'm not going to have a car, I'm going to take the bus like I took there. It's so simple, it's so easy, I don't need a car. And then she realized she wasn't in a place that was accommodating for that and quickly had to find a car because it didn't work here. But this is what our young people are interested in. This is what our baby boomers as they age and want to be able to get around without having to do transportation cars. I love my car, but I'm looking forward to the future where I can actually get on the transit and get around. I think some of these plans as to how we can build out the infrastructure in the area, which is the purpose of the Met Council, to see bigger than one city boundary, one city line, and to see the whole area, and to look at the long-range growth and needs of the entire region, it's crucial. And transit is certainly a part of that, and that's the part I wanted to focus on here because of my appointment.
Madam Chair and Representative.
Ms. Kirsten.
I certainly agree that transit is important. It's important to realize, though, that there is a difference between fixed rail transit and buses. The more buses, the better. That is absolutely right. The problem that you describe is what's known as the last mile problem, and that is the incredible time-consuming nature of transit, unless it's basically going downtown. Absolutely, that's where transit, in particular buses, make a lot of sense. But the Star Tribune had a very interesting comment about the Green Line, which covers that 11-mile distance between Minneapolis and St. Paul in basically close to an hour. Cars are half that time. The Star Tribune said, in a contest with a skilled long-distance runner, a Green Line train would lose every time. This is the kind of problem we're talking about, and the extraordinary expense of fixed rail transit, now streetcars we're hearing about. If you want to help people get out of poverty, one of the best things you can do is to decrease as much as possible the time it takes to get them to a variety of jobs that they can hold. And in many cases, when the jobs aren't right downtown, transit simply isn't the answer.
Thank you very much. And I think we're going to try to proceed here with the next testifier. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. We have Gary Shelton, Scott County, and Randy Maluchnik. I don't know if you're coming up together or if you are here. Oh, there they are. All right. Great. Welcome to the subcommittee, gentlemen. And I don't know who's going to proceed first, but please give us your name and where you're from.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Randy Maluchnik. I'm the chair of Carver County Board of Commissioners. I have with me today the Scott County Administrator, Gary Shelton.
So, very good. Yeah. Who's going to go first?
I think I'll do it, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us this opportunity to address you regarding our concerns with Thrive MSP 2040. I'd like to begin by noting that while I'm a Carver County Commissioner and Mr. Shelton is a Scott County Administrator, we are here today representing some of the collective thoughts and concerns of the five suburban counties, which include Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Washington, and Scott. With respect to Thrive MSP 2040, our regional metropolitan governance structure in general, and I wanted to begin by providing a brief overview of Thrive MSP 2040 as we collectively see it, and then I'll ask Mr. Shelton to provide some more detailed information on our concerns with the transportation component, keeping in mind your time restrictions here, Madam Chair. The Metropolitan Council repeatedly fails in exercising any meaningful engagement that includes locally elected officials in a dialogue to develop regional governance policies. The Metropolitan Council's approach to planning process has reduced elected officials to mere commenters. We certainly have been relegated to the bleachers. Thrive MSP 2040 was adopted only a few weeks after comments were received. While hundreds of comments were provided, they were generally brushed aside and responded to as noted, when some type of a real explanation would be appropriate and more transparent. It was blatantly obvious that most public engagement comments were being ignored. Thrive MSP 2040 states that we will strive to achieve local visions within the regional policy framework, but lack any demonstrated understanding of local perception. The time frame for developing the policy plans that support Thrive MSP 2040 vision were not coordinated. Policy plans and implementation process was being developed concurrently, not sequentially, but concurrently. Without an adequate and sequential process, any commenting on Thrive MSP 2040 became nothing more than an empty exercise to fulfill a statutory illusion of listening, as opposed to a true process meant to inform, impact, and help direct resources. It was clearly a process that promoted predetermined outcomes over transparent public comment. The most grievous example was within the area of transportation. The Thrive MSP 2040 was completed several months behind schedule and approved near the end of the transportation policy plan preparation period. Furthermore, the scope and direction of the regional solicitation process was already determined before Thrive MSP 2040 was adopted and the draft of the transportation plan was completed. The suburban counties strongly support the need for regional planning, and with an entire regional perspective, a real collaboration as regional partners. We agree with the overarching efforts proposed in Thrive MSP 2040 that thinking and working together will help the region achieve high quality life for our citizens and allow the region to remain vibrant and globally competitive. However, we have significant concerns that the implementation of the Thrive MSP 2040 by the Metropolitan Council will expand its mission with minimal engagement or input from locally elected officials. One of the more interesting expansions of the Council's perceived role is their current focus on poverty and inequality. As counties, we appreciate the Metropolitan Council's recognition of the negative consequences of poverty and inequality in our region. However, we believe that their process and approach are misguided. During their process, we were astounded that in developing their approach, the Metropolitan Council made no attempt to engage the region's counties in constructive dialogue on the causes and strategies related to poverty and inequality. I don't have to remind the folks in this room that counties are the forefront of work that stem poverty, inequality, and blight within the metropolitan area. Counties fully support the goal of improving the lives of individuals and neighborhoods and the importance of closing gaps in achievement, employment, housing, and true transportation access. And we certainly acknowledge that there's no one right answer or way to reduce poverty. Furthermore, we understand that to successfully reduce poverty requires a combination of economic, social, education, and political activities. However, we question the Metropolitan Council's approach to addressing these issues. The Metropolitan's singular focus on racially concentrated areas of poverty and their arbitrary standard as to what constitutes a racially concentrated area is of our concern to us. There are areas of concentrated poverty across this entire region. And while some of these areas may be associated with racial concentrations, there's also a possibility that there's areas of disabled and population of age concentrations. And these possibilities were only given lip service across the entire scope of the progress or the process that we were discussing today. Thrive MSP 2040 states that the Metropolitan Council would be adopting a data-driven approach, yet the Metropolitan Council has provided no data, again, no data, to demonstrate that these policies have been applied in other regions effectively. And isolated from other initiatives, school reform, job training, business initiatives, neighborhood and community activism, etc., it is very questionable whether these policies will be effective. It is very questionable whether these policies will be effective. Another area where we question the Metropolitan Council's focus and approach relates to economic competitiveness. The Metropolitan Council was created to aid the region in development by providing coordination and planning for land use in major systems, transportation, wastewater, and regional parks. Thrive MSP 2040, the Metropolitan Council states that it has identified economic competitiveness as a new emphasis and that they will use their infrastructure investments to advance economic prosperity. The Metropolitan Council further states that they will use prosperity and economic competitiveness as a lens through which to evaluate investment decisions. While it is still unclear as to what the Metropolitan Council intends to use this lens or how they will focus it, Thrive MSP 2040 in general would indicate that the lens may well be the Metropolitan Council's focus on poverty and the manner in which they have chosen to define, designate communities. The Metropolitan Council's purpose for a greater degree of community categorization or designation is unclear, and the purpose for both concerning and somewhat confusing to us. The Thrive MSP 2040, the Council attempts to differentiate between communities like Stillwater, with a population of 18,225, listed as suburban. Shakopee, population of 37,076, listed as suburban edge. And Chanhassen, population 22,952, listed as an emerging suburban edge. In terms of geographic location, population, demographics, etc., this almost appears to be a difference without any distinction. But Thrive MSP 2040 would hint that the policy plans that they are putting forth to support Thrive MSP 2040 would indicate that these destinations may prove to have significant impacts on the community's ability to garden regional investment. Before I ask Mr. Shelton to speak more specifically to transportation, I would also like to make a couple of general observations regarding Thrive MSP 2040 and our regional governance and planning structure. First, suburban counties believe that all parts of the region need investment and should be valued equally, and that Thrive MSP 2040, combined with the policy plans, are not proposed or do not propose to include that value for the entire region. Second, our regional governance and planning structure lacks transparency and accountability to all the region or residents of the entire region. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak this morning, and now I'll turn it over to Mr. Shelton for the transportation portion. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Maluchnik. And Mr. Shelton, we're going to try to get to the other. We have three or four other testifiers, so maybe you can speed us through this.
Madam Chair, members, I'll move as quickly as I can.
Would you please introduce yourself to the tape?
I am Gary Shelton, and I am the administrator for Scott County, Minnesota. The Thrive MSP 2040 plan, as this slide shows, is intended to guide a number of other policy plans. I'm going to speak only to the transportation portion of Thrive and the transportation policy plan in general. The view that the suburban counties have with the Thrive process and some of the common areas of concern we have is first that it's been stated before that it's a flawed process. The documents were prepared concurrently as opposed to sequentially. So while Thrive was not even fully developed, while Thrive was not even approved, the transportation policy plan was already being adopted or being prepared. Prior to the adoption of the transportation policy plan, the process, which is referred to as a regional solicitation, that is intended to support and implement the transportation policy plan or some of its elements, was already adopted and put out there so that what you have is a predetermined outcome. So while we talk about input and we talk about comments and we talk about the ability of people to influence the process, when these plans are being prepared concurrently, when comment periods are relatively short, and when parts of the plans are actually adopted prior to other parts which they're supposed to support even being adopted, it's hard to believe that the input that is provided by the public or by elected officials has any real meaning. As has been stated previously, we believe there is a lack of two-way dialogue with elected officials, the council, or the council staff. There was a comment period that was provided. As was stated earlier, the five suburban counties worked collaboratively to put together their concerns and their comments on the transportation section of this plan. They invited the Metropolitan Council to a joint meeting of the five boards and presented their concerns, and then repeatedly requested that there be some type of follow-up working session on their comments, because you can't, in a large public setting with 20-some-odd commissioners, have that back-and-forth dialogue. It was meant to lay out our concerns, hear their overview response, and then move on to a working session. But to date, and this plan will be adopted shortly, but to date, there has been no working session between the council and the five suburban counties. So through October, November, December, January, and now into February, that request has been repeatedly denied by the Metropolitan Council. What they have said is that they are willing to meet individually with counties. They're not willing, or at least have shown no willingness so far, to meet with the suburban counties in a working session to discuss those concerns. It provides for a very limited role or effectiveness also in this process for the Transportation Advisory Board. The Transportation Advisory Board is only brought into the process as a commenter on the periphery. They don't have any type of actual approval within these processes. And when we talk about, and that's their limited role, but the effectiveness is also somewhat limited by the nature in which the Transportation Advisory Board, which is critical, as we understand it, to the MPO, the nature in which it is actually constructed. If you look at the population in the region, in the Ramsey and Hennepin County, the urban centers, there's about 58% of the population, about 42% are in the five suburban counties. But when you start to look at the TAB representation, there are first 17 elected officials, which are indicated by the stars on this map, that are appointed by the various boards to represent their area. But then there are 12 that are appointed by the Metropolitan Council. There are another four that are agency appointments. By the time you put all these stars together, it is virtually impossible for the elected officials to have any meaningful implementation or any meaningful say in these particular plans, because as you're well aware, locally elected officials, mayors, city council members, and county commissioners all have other jobs. It is virtually impossible for all 17 of them to always make every meeting. And quite often we have seen, especially in the last number of months, that when important decisions come to them where the elected officials might actually outnumber the appointed and agency officials, you see things put off until the 16 can be there, so that that one person difference is meaningless in terms of the effectiveness of the TAB in having any real say in the transportation. If you look at where they're clustered, they're almost all clustered relatively close and into an area that is only 58% of the population. We believe that the plan, 2040, Thrive 2040, and the policy plan, the TPP, which supports it, fails to articulate a vision for a robust highway system in the whole region. The policy and supporting plan statements are skewed to transit and non-motorized modes of transportation, and the five suburban counties, three of which are members of CTIP, are not anti-transit folks. They are just saying that there needs to be a robust highway system, particularly in the suburban counties, to support transit, because virtually all of the transit in the five suburban counties are dependent upon roads. Highway investment fails to define a vision aligned with travel, behavior, and growth. It fails to recognize economic importance of the interregional corridors and connections to greater Minnesota, and fails to promote investments in areas projected for significant growth.
And Mr. Shelton, you have some great stuff here. I don't know how much time it's going to take, and I know there's other people from distances, so if there's any way to summarize, would appreciate that.
I will try and go through a couple of slides just very quickly with no real comment on them. This slide just highlights a statement out of the Thrive document that clearly shows that investment intentions along highways are still going to be focused investments on transit and managed lanes. This access and mobility piece, if these are also taken out of the document, really look at what's the focus. You don't find the word investment and highways in this when it comes to the urban core or the urban or suburban communities. But even in those areas where they refer to as edge or emerging edge, you still see the focus. You see investment in strategic transit. And they will use the word transportation quite often instead of the word highway or roads. And when you dig deeper into the plan, they're generally talking about bikes and pedestrians and transit. They're not talking about roads and highways, which are critical to the five suburban counties. When you look at how we get there, 76% commute to work, 89% drive in cars, but the majority of the objectives and strategies relate to transit, walking, and biking, which accounts for only 11%, and by nobody's measure is that 11% going to grow substantially even in the next 20 or 30 years in terms of how we get from one place to the other. So if you talk about access and mobility, you have to look at the road system. When you look at population growth, only 2% in the last 10 years were in that urban core, while 17% of the growth in the last 10 years in the 2000 to 2010 occurred in the suburbs. If you look at the growth that is projected, again, while they're projecting considerably more growth, 22% in the Hennepin-Ramsey, the urban core area, the five suburban counties still are projected to have 39%. However, when you look at, the same is true for growth in households, but when you look at the investment scenario, it is almost all focused not in the areas that show even the greatest amount of growth. It's focused in the areas that don't show the greatest amount of growth. Even when you look to the additional revenue scenario, because what we hear is it's a constrained plan. It's constrained for roads. It's not constrained at all for transit. But when you look at the highway investment force, even with additional revenue, what you see is additional investment in the urban core and not in the suburban areas. And my final slide is really talks about freight connections and our and the interregional corridors. And when you look at the interregional corridors like Highway 10, Highway 36, Highway 52, Highway 169, they are absolutely critical, critical to the lifeblood not only of the metropolitan area, but also to greater Minnesota, and yet this plan ignores them in their entirety. We talk about investment in areas as it's appropriate to their development. We talk about the importance of natural resources. I want to relay just a little bit of a story from Scott County that I think is very specific to the interregional corridors and their lack of investment. Our Planning Commission just this week denied the Metropolitan Council's plan talks specifically about the importance of aggregate to the lifeblood and the economy of this region. The aggregate building the new stadium primarily is coming up the 169 and 212 corridors. That's where most of our aggregate comes from, outside of the urban core. Our Planning Commission just turned down a gravel mine. What was their primary reason for turning down the gravel mine? As we have said repeatedly, 169 is no longer a safe interregional corridor. And what they said is, we don't believe it's safe for loaded gravel trucks anymore to get out onto this road to make a right turn and then make a left turn, because there are no interchanges, there is not the proper access to this particular road. Therefore, we're not going to allow this gravel mine. That won't change.
Okay. There's so much to say. I understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's very, very, very helpful. We're going to move to we have a city councilman here, Mr. Lanoux.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then we're going to go to, if we can keep you to 2 to 3 minutes, we have Matt Look, County Commissioner, and several other mayors that want to address us as well. So, Mr. Lanoux.
Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I served on our planning
commission. Please state your name and.
Larry Lanoux, City of Grant. I'm a council member there. I served in the Planning Commission. I am one of these people that did go to one of their meetings. I watched the people come up there, bring good suggestions, bring concerns, and they've been ignored. They've not been followed up on. Like I said, it's a listening session that is required, and they don't follow up. One of my examples that I have out there, and many of you, I probably have worked in probably all your cities. For a living, I install sewer lift stations, stormwater, and sewer. I do it exclusively for a living. I work with Met Council on different projects throughout our seven-county area. And I'm here to tell you, they're placing stormwater systems out in East Bethel on the edge of their deal because they don't have the population to even open them up. We have to hurry up, put up a lift station so that they can open up their wastewater treatment plant so we can get a trailer park. They're putting them on the outskirts so that they can drive population out there. Our city has a motto. It's called a home in the country. Our greatest fear is Met Council will force us to be a home in the city. They have done this to Lake Elmo against its wishes. Now, on the average lift station I put in your town, it will probably be between a 5 to 15 horsepower pump. In Lake Elmo, against the city's wishes, that lift station had 350 horsepower sewer pumps. They couldn't turn it on because if they did, or bring sewage in, it would go septic. They didn't have enough people to even operate these things. But since putting it and installing it right now, there are 6 different developers putting over 800 plus homes in the city of Lake Elmo against the city's wishes. That will change the try to get a appointment at the Lake Elmo Inn after that comes on. I'm going to tell you it's going to be pretty tough. But I'm going to.
Can you wrap
they are
up,
developing
Mr.
what's going on. one of the examples that I've got here that I'll show you how we can save $600 million. Oh. And I passed this out to you. I brought this to them several years ago. But it simply is going to draw water from the Mississippi.
One more minute, Mr. Lanoux, okay?
Pardon?
One more minute.
Basically, they've done nothing to replenish the aquifer they're depleting. They're asking, if you look at their document back there, they want $623 million to implement a plan they can do for $23 million. They know about the plan. It's feasible. I've done the study, the leg work with the people that can actually do it. And actually, Met Council refuses to come and study this seriously. Representative Fisher knows about it.
Okay.
If you'd like any more information, my number's on there.
Super.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Lanoux. Great. Now we have Mr. Matt Look.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Matt Look. I'm a Anoka County Commissioner. I represent District 1 in Anoka County. Vice Chair of the Anoka County Board, I'm a member in good standing on CTIB. I sit on TAB. I'm a Chair of the Anoka County Regional Rail Authority. I sit on GEARS and NCDA, and I mention this not for credential purposes, but to illustrate that a lot of my day is involved with transportation-related issues. And Thrive 2040 is a big concern of ours, no question about it. It's a 500-page broad statement plan, and by the way, I was asked previously if it was going to be complimentary comments to what the Met Council made earlier, and while I wouldn't bet on that, I think it will be informative. The Thrive 2040 is a 500-page broad statement plan. This plan is implemented through what is proposed in the TPP policy plan, housing plan, park subplans, etc. And this is where you might say the devil's in the details, and we certainly have great concern on how this is implemented. Anoka County, in full disclosure, was engaged in this development of this plan early on through a partner agency work group, and this was a positive exchange of ideas and information, and we had great hope that our investment of time would be reflected in this plan, but many of the comments that were made quite simply didn't make it past the cutting room floor. And I appreciate earlier it was indicated there was kind of a distinction between transportation and transit, and we do need to define that. For the purposes here, I'm going to refer to transportation as roads and bridges, and transit as LRT and trains and that sort of thing. In the plan, there's a common statement made throughout that connecting communities, fostering regional prosperity, these are all good ideas. The statement is supported by the idea that transportation is the foundation to maintain and improve the region. I'm thinking the word transportation is all-inclusive there. Today's transportation continues to play a crucial role in the region's quality of life and its economic success. Reliable, efficient, safe, and affordable transportation connects the region's residents with jobs, schools, community amenities, families, and businesses, and it supports the movement of goods and services. It goes on to say that our extensive, well-managed road and highways move the region's people and goods. Now, I might disagree with the well-managed and extensive part of it, but certainly we agree on most of it. And why at Anoka County do we agree on most of it? Because 84% of the trips, as was indicated earlier, in the region travel by car and truck. While the previous sentiments sound great, they too were forgotten along the way, in my opinion, rendering this plan to lack the vision and the action steps necessary to meet the needs of the metropolitan area. And I think it's for this reason that the five-county consortium was convened, proving that at least five of the seven counties concurred that this plan had significant flaws in the reasoning of how it was going to be implemented. Overwhelming focus is placed on the needs of the central core of the region, and the lion's share of the strategies identified in the plan are solely transit-based. While transit plays a role in the overall transportation system, it does not address 84% of the movement. That's the movement of goods and services. We need a reliable road network, and that's why it's very important. Of course, the reason why that is because without a reliable road network, you will see an increase in your cost of goods and services. And I sat on TAB and kind of gave a little economic lessons that when the potato farmer comes in and can't get through the congestion on the highways to get to your grocery store and it costs them twice as much to deliver their product, does the potato farmer pay for it? No, you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay every dime of that increase. Essentially, the plan is not consistent with the needs of the region. Even the Met Council projections show that 80% of the population growth and 75% of the employment growth will occur outside of what has been defined as the urban center of the metropolitan area. In response to this, the plan suggests focusing on MinPass lanes and preservation of the regional highway system, largely, I believe, because the federal government requires performance standards now. The missing vision here is strategic capacity enhancements for the stated growth. We know it's coming. We know where it's going. We think MinPass lanes is the best plan of preparation. It doesn't connect with me, sorry. The solution is increasing funding, or so we hear so often. Never once is it recommended that we adjust priorities. While the plan justifies spending money on transit, it somehow turns a blind eye to 84% of the non-transit trips out there today. If transit is a political favor of the day, it will be problematic to neglect an economy, our economy, based on reliable transportation that we have today on roads by investing in areas that will not address anticipated growth. Madam Chair, there is so much more to address as it relates to the plan, and I'm confident that you too would end up shaking your head, as we are. Perhaps the federal timeline to execute the grant to write the plan was too short to really be successful. Perhaps this is why the plan was adopted prior to the completion of the public comment period. Imagine having a public comment period but no genuine desire to implement those comments. Kind of disrespectful. This is precisely how we feel as counties as well, and this has not been an inclusive process, in my opinion. We've not been included in this. We're the people on the front line, if you will, boots on the ground, not really asked what your opinion is going to be on it, and for those that were involved in it, our engineers, wasn't included in the plan. We feel strongly that the outcomes were decided upon long before the plan was completed. And unfortunately, and this is my opinion part, I want to disclaim that. Unfortunately, the Thrive 2040 plan has become, in my opinion, a special interest statement for two counties and one nonprofit group, that being Habitat for Humanity. While I'm not opposed to Habitat's work, I believe it's inappropriate for a nonprofit to direct limited governmental resources through a plan that enhances their mission.
Mr. Look?
Yes.
We need to proceed.
Sure.
Move on.
Two more statements. We're confident the plan doesn't address our concerns of growth, congestion, the safety today. Essentially, it doesn't meet our needs, and it will certainly make our situations worse. We have a Mercy Unity Hospitals. Number one complaint in the area right now is getting people to the hospital. If you're having a heart attack, they can't get you there efficiently. That's a problem in our area. And sadly, the I-35W bridge collapse demonstrated the deficiency and lagging maintenance of our existing infrastructure. In Anoka County, in the last 5 years, 16 people were killed, 1,593 people were injured in highway crashes every single year. This is unacceptable. And as far as this discussion has gone today, we've seen a desire to speak about humility in the implementation of this plan. That's not been our experience, not on TAB, not on CTIB, not anywhere. Matter of fact, we've seen exactly the opposite, and that's disturbing. So I'll stand for
very
questions.
Good.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Look. If there are no questions, do you have a question? No. We have, yes, thank you very, very much. We do have several people from, I think, is it Carver County?
Yes, we do. We have Mayor Steve Washburn and Mayor Tina Diedrich that wanted to address the subcommittee.
And I believe you've promised to be very brief. So please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Mayor Steve Washburn, City of Watertown. I will be very, very brief. I do not have a prepared statement. I can tell you this, though. I represent 4,200 people in Carver County, and this plan does not reflect the needs of our community, not at all. I think so many points have been hit on, it's hard to pick one or two, but I get a lot of questions about our economic prosperity and how are we going to prosper in our community. And it's clear that the investment directives from this plan are focusing all this investment in the urban core. And it's very difficult for me to stand in front of my community when we've really had very little interaction. And in fact, the Met Council pushed our numbers down heavily until we pushed back and said, no, we're still going to continue to grow. So it's very troubling when I sit here today, listen to the presentation from the Met Council, and struggle with how this is meeting the needs of the people in my community. And I know that feeling is felt by many mayors, many council members all throughout the area. And I could
go on and on and on, but I just want you to see the face of someone in really rural Met Council area and how this program negatively affects our community. And with that, I'll yield to Tina.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tina Diedrich. I'm the mayor of Norwood Young America. I just want to reiterate a lot of the comments that have been said, the impact that this this Thrive 2040 has on our community. Primarily, I want to speak just on the particularly the transportation. The Highway 212 runs through our community as well as Highway 5, and it's 212 is the only interregional corridor that has gaps in its four-lane highways coming out through Carver County, and that's a significant safety concern, as well as economic growth. And I have the fortunate to be living a block from the train and two blocks from the highway, and I will tell you the increase of traffic, truck traffic in particular, and the amount of trains and heavy trains that shake our house has increased a lot in the last 3 years. And we have a school crossing, five lanes of Highway 212, including a turn lane. And these items, this lack of vision all the way out to include the more rural communities by this plan, it's disheartening. It's hard to plan. We've had, in the last 4 years, three distribution centers interested in the space that we have available in our community industrial park. And the inquiries came from the Greater MSP, and we would fit all the criteria except for the access to a four-lane highway. And that would limit the amount of truck traffic that could enter back and forth into these distribution centers. So we were just crossed off the list. And that's discouraging economic-wise for our community. We want to grow. We have the capacity to grow. We have, you know, two highways running through our community. And I think that this plan for Thrive 2040 doesn't address our needs.
Thank you, Ms. Diedrich. That's very helpful to have the firsthand examples. And thanks then to everyone for testifying, and we will adjourn the committee.